welcome into the all new All Ball. I'm your boy Doug Gottlieb, and all full disclosure, we had to re-record kind of the open to this one because there's breaking news: the NCAA tournament will have no fans. So to those of you who made fun of my alma mater, Oklahoma State, for not filling up Gallagher Arena, they were just preparing for the NCAA tournament. That's all. It is crazy, though, that the NCAA is getting out ahead of this thing. Meanwhile, all these tournaments are being played. Like, I'm watching the Pac-12, the Big Ten, the Big 12, the SEC. They're all playing in front of full houses. So it's like... And I get it that the information is late and teams, you know, trips are already planned, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it is absolutely fascinating to see how you turn these slow-moving ships around. My guess would be NIT is going to be canceled too, although at the time of this recording, only the CBI has been canceled. Only the CBI. So how does it affect the tournament? Well, first, I just honestly wonder why they would play it at the Georgia Dome, why they wouldn't play it eventually at like Georgia Tech's arena or even at the Hawks practice facility. Why not play it there? Anybody? But I don't think it affects the first and second round. Crowds aren't really a part of the issue. Like, can crowds turn on the higher seeded team? Of course they can. That's kind of part of the tradition of the NCAA tournament, as anyone who's been there knows, which is, crowds can absolutely turn on a dime. You know, a Duke is in a close game, even if they're playing in the state of North Carolina, and the home crowd can turn against the higher seed. But outside of that, doesn't totally change at all, or doesn't even modestly change the outcome of games. But the Final Four, like, that's a fan crazy event. I went there as a kid. I bring my kid, and my nephew goes there. And, you know, what do you do with FanFest? Obviously, you have to cancel it. All those concerts that you have, got to cancel it. Now the fans can't go to the games. Like, this is a weird, almost zombie apocalypse type of time. I would guess, I'm not going to be one of these guys that tells you everybody's freaking out. I would guess they're freaking out for a reason. There's got to be worse news before there's better news. But what a change. Like, what a year this is going to be, where we look back and like, oh, that was the NCAA tournament where there were no fans there, which means there'll be no fans at NBA games as well. Or you run the possibility of not having NBA games. Or the question becomes, with all the revenue lost to vendors, who, that's a big portion of why they can't cut the number of NBA games, is what do you do with all those vendors and all the money that the vendors make? Well, now they won't make any money. So do you shut the arenas and play at the practice facilities? Same length court. Training rooms are right there. Many of them have stands for essential personnel. Do you want to play in an empty Staples Center or in an empty, you know, Chase Center? Would you rather play at a practice facility? I don't know in terms of being cost effective or how it affects camera angles, because now it becomes basically playing a soundstage. But it is a fascinating time we live in, and one that it'll just change the outcome. It'll change the feeling, won't change the outcome. You know, fans have never made or missed one basket. They don't influence nearly as much as you'd think. So there'll be no fans, but there will be games. And what's interesting is it feels like the domes have been reconfigured recently, and the fans have been more into it. Like, I remember last year at the championship game, the semifinals in Minnesota, I felt like the fans were more into it, and the dome was built in a way in which it was a better watch than previously. Now we won't have it. And then I guess the question becomes, does any of this become the new normal? Not having media members inside the locker room, is that the new normal? I would say probably yes. But what about everything else? You know, not having fans at the game, or do we stop shaking hands? Right. What about this becomes the new normal? In the meantime, look, the games are still going to be crazy. The endings are still going to be spectacular. The cutaways are just going to be tighter than they've ever been in the past. And now we don't have to worry about which site is a good site, which site is a bad site. You could play them in all practice gyms and nobody would know. The games will go on, and we will cover them really, really well for you here on All Ball. Casey Alexander is our guest on this pod. He is the head coach of Belmont. He played at Belmont. He was an assistant at Belmont. He left Belmont to become the head coach at Stetson for a couple years. That's in Florida, the Mad Hatters. Great nickname. Great nickname. And then, of course, he went back to Nashville, where Belmont's located, but was the head coach at Lipscomb. Got a little Lipscomb, right? Ah, sorry, it's a bad joke. Anyway, we've talked Lipscomb basketball in pods in the past with his best player that he ever had there. And then this offseason, when Rick Byrd, the legendary longtime head coach at Belmont, retired, he decided to make the trip 2 miles down the road and become the head coach at Belmont. So it was a big thing, especially in Nashville and that level of basketball. And Belmont has become such a significant program in the OVC, and of course Lipscomb in the A-Sun. So we'll catch up with Casey Alexander. Plus, they beat Murray State in epic kind of classic Belmont coaching fashion. Where did he get the last second backdoor play? You'll be surprised at where you hear that. And what Murray State could have done to unravel that play. We'll get to that upcoming as well. I want to give you this thought on LeBron's weekend. You know, what happens to the... My kids call them noobs. I don't know. I don't know if that's a national word or just a kid word or just an Orange County kid word. Noobs are people who are new to whatever they're doing. In basketball, we've coined them civilians, right? And maybe that's in all sports. People who are talking about sports that don't really know the sport or are just kind of fans of it, didn't play it, or don't see it at a higher level. To the noob or to the civilian, LeBron is ever bit as dominant as he was previously. Just look at the stats. Look at the wins. Look at how he played this weekend. If you're watching at a higher level, you're sitting there and going like, it's really amazing considering how he can conserve energy, take plays off, how he can get where he wants to get in fewer movements. How can he can adjust to the fact that his body, though for a normal human being, he's a freak of nature. For the NBA, he does look like a slightly less athletic version of himself. Talk about LeBron over the weekend. Nonetheless, my case for him being the MVP was encapsulating all that he's doing. And yes, this is kind of giving him a pass for occasionally taking more defensive possessions off or hiding on defense for... You know, for playing bully ball and slower and posting up on offense and things. I give him a pass because he's not only trying to elevate his team to a higher level than they could normally play at without him or with another star, but I would also tell you that I think he's elevating himself to a higher level and kind of figuring out where he should be and how he can get to where he wants to get. This is not a shot at Giannis. Giannis is unbelievable. But I think there are a good list of guys you could put in Giannis's situation where you surround him with shooters and they would be close offensively and defensively to what he does. I offered up Ben Simmons. People are like, you're crazy. He doesn't shoot, let alone can't shoot. Do I think he would average the same number of points? No. I think Ben Simmons is actually a better passer. He's not the rim protector defensive that Giannis is, but he's, if he can be that floating guy, he's already, I think, leading the NBA in steals. Like he's a good versatile defender. And the bigger thing is if you surround him just with shooters and space out, like Ben Simmons becomes really, really, really difficult to defend. Now, is he easier to defend than Giannis? I guess. Yes, Giannis will take threes, but it's not like he makes them at a high clip, but he does at least take them. My case is simply that whether it's James Harden or Russell Westbrook or Giannis or Ben Simmons, or if you put Jason Tatum, you put a lot of these star players and support them with the type of overall defense and the concepts that they're playing. Offensively, you space the floor and kind of give them carte blanche to play how they want to play, pass out to open shooters. I think you'd see... Milwaukee's a good team, a well-coached team. I think they win a lot of games. I think they put up a lot of numbers. I can't honestly conceive of any NBA player having anywhere close to the effect on the Lakers that LeBron does. Now, some of it is just, hey, that's who LeBron is. He becomes, you build around him specifically. But I do think between the leadership, the toughness, the strength, the versatility, he's even motivating himself to play at a higher level than he's normally capable of. That would be my case for LeBron being the MVP, even if in a one-game scenario, I think generally I would take Kawhi over him. You know, I think he's going to struggle in the playoffs to be as physical as he was consistently with. I think that'll take a lot out of him with the Kawhi Leonards of the world. But we'll see. We shall see. Still a great weekend for the Lakers. They did lose, as it was recorded last night, to the Nets. LeBron did miss a dead layup. Whether that's dead legs or exhaustion or just goosing up a layup up there, I can't tell you. Let's take you to our interview this week.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Another year, another postseason tournament for Casey Alexander, the head coach in his first year at his alma mater at Belmont Place. He was an assistant before leaving, getting a head coaching job at Stetson, at Lipscomb, and now back replacing the incomparable Rick Byrd. Casey, we're, I don't know how many hours removed from taking your alma mater to the tournament. You did this before when you're at Lipscomb cross town. Compare and contrast the feeling of taking down Murray State with getting Lipscomb to the tournament.
Well, it's a great feeling, I can tell you that. You know, being back at Belmont has been a real honor, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. This program has won a lot of games recently. This is our ninth NCAA tournament since 2006, and so naturally, every time you go to one, you wonder, will you ever go back? So to be able to do it in our first year is pretty special.
When you got there as a player, 1992, you showed up. You guys weren't Division I yet, were you?
No, we were NAI, yeah.
What was it like?
We were good. My senior year, we were 37-2. Our two losses were to Division I team, Western Kentucky, who played in the postseason that year, and then the semifinals of the NAIA National Tournament. We were ranked number one all year. So we had good teams, especially at the end of those NAIA years. But gosh, it went downhill fast. we were an independent for 4 or 5 years, and when we first made the move to Division I, straight from NAIA to Division I, we didn't have a conference to play in. We had no postseason play. So there were some lean years until we finally joined what used to be the Transamerica and became the A-Sun Conference, like 2001 maybe.
So what you're saying is your senior year you guys choked, right? That's what happened?
Well, yeah, I guess if we have to win the whole thing in order to be considered a success, I guess we choked.
So the first time you met Rick Byrd was where?
He was recruiting a high school teammate of mine heavily. I'm a Nashville native. I went to Brentwood Academy, a local private school here, and he was recruiting a teammate of mine who also had a great career at Belmont, and I was just kind of tagged along, really. That's how I ended up at Belmont. I knew I wanted to coach. I knew he was a great coach. That's how I ended up here.
Okay, who was your high school teammate?
David Knox was his name.
Okay, so David Knox. So you show up on campus at Belmont, and what's your first memory of the place?
Belmont was a lot different then. We had about 2,000 students. It was a small school, basically a commuter school. It had two pockets, real heavy into the music business. That's where most of our students came from, and then the athletes, and almost nobody in between. So now we're about 8,500 students, almost 9,000 maybe. We've built literally almost $1 billion worth of buildings in the last 10 years when our current projects are over. So it's changed quite a bit.
Yeah, I'm sure. What was that process like to go from NAIA to Division I, not having a conference? Like, how did Coach Byrd do it? What were the building blocks that allowed you guys to have not just success at Belmont, but sustained success?
Yeah, that's it's the answer to your question is probably the most meaningful part of the whole thing to both myself and especially Coach Byrd, in a sense that you go back to those early 90s when I was playing on the NAIA team, and you take the team that's in our locker room right now, they're the same kids. Like, the players are better, but everything else is the same. We never compromised. We kept recruiting a certain kind of kid that plays a certain way, that does things the right way, that would have gone to college anyway, would have graduated from college anyway, knows what it means to be a teammate, and that's been the secret to our success all along.
How do you identify those when you're recruiting?
Well, you got to be willing. you got to be willing to take the risk to do it differently. You know, I mean, you know, you just got to trust your gut. You know, you do a little extra work. We have to put it in perspective. Since our move to Division I in 2001, we have 17 academic All-Americans on our Division I academic All-Americans. Well, the next closest is Butler with 10. And then there's many that don't have any, of course. And so that's the best proof I can give you. We've had two transfers out of our program in 15 years wow. because we've chosen the right kind of guys. And, you know, and that's the reason. We would say that's the reason we win. A lot of people, when we made that move, say, hey, you can't win that way. You're going to have to change how you recruit and what you do. And as it turns out, it's really the reason why we have won.
What made you take the Stetson job when you're at Belmont, longtime assistant? Was it just like Coach Bird was never leaving? You're like, man, I got to go get a head coaching job.
Essentially, you know, it's and my job changed here, you know, just because of the nature of the program, going from NAIA to bad Division I to good Division I to NCAA tournament Division I. So it was easy to stay, and Nashville is home to me. But I wanted the opportunity. Stetson was in the same league at the time, the Atlantic Sun, and I felt like a comparable place. And so I just felt like it was the right time. I didn't know when Coach Bird was going to leave. I didn't even know what was going to happen for sure when he left. So I felt like I just had to make that move, and it turned out to be a good one.
All right, so you're there 2 years, and Lipscomb comes calling. Now, this is to come back home, but to be, you know, across the street, essentially, from your alma mater. What was the decision like to leave Stetson after just 2 years, and you got the thing almost to 500 with the Hatters, and then come back home to Lipscomb?
Yeah, it was eye-opening for a lot of people. You know, a lot of the Lipscomb people were saying, what in the world are you doing hiring a Belmont guy? And all the Belmont people were saying, how in the world could you ever go to Lipscomb? What are you thinking? And so it was surprising for a lot of folks. But the truth is, the universities are very similar, comparable with, you know, in how they want things to be done. Both universities very supportive of basketball. I knew a lot of people at Lipscomb. Very familiar, obviously. They've been our rival for a long, long, long time, only 2 miles apart, and most of our history being in the same conference together. So it was really an easy step. And I've said all along, I mean, Nashville was important. I mean, that was kind of a benefit of the whole thing. But I would have gone to Lipscomb if it was in Birmingham or St. Louis or you name it. I felt like it was a really good job, and it turned out to be proven so.
Okay, so we talked on my pod with Garrison Matthews, obviously, who is your best player, your superstar at Lipscomb, part of that amazing team that took Lipscomb to their first NCAA tournament. Can you confirm that you guys didn't really want, he wasn't really your primary target, right? That's what he said?
Well, we liked him. We knew that we liked him and we wanted him to come, but we have been recruiting somebody else that we felt like was more of a sure thing. This other player, we had put a lot of time into. We felt like if we could get him, it would help us accelerate our progress. And so we told the other guy, and he was slow walking the whole thing. But you know, it went his list went from 25 to 15 to 10 to 5, and you know, we said, we're going to let you take your visits. We're not going to do anything until you're finished. And it turned out to be us and one other school. And we told Garrison all along, hey, we're waiting on this guy. We told him we would. We promised him we would. And if he says no, we're coming to you immediately, and that's exactly what happened. Turned out Garrison, you know, was the best player Lipscomb's ever had, and the other guy had a good career, but yeah. We would have made the wrong decision had it worked out the other way.
Okay, so, but he also said, like, he was a football player, basketball player. He's like a football player playing basketball. He said, like, after his freshman year, he just, like, all of a sudden the light switch went on. How much were you a part of that? Like, what's, as a coach, and like, you guys do it, at your level, they're all four and done, right? Or five and
yep.
done.
Yeah.
So it is a process. And, you know, the dream is you bring in a kid, he's a backup the first year or two. Obviously, Garrison, I think because of an injury, got to start his freshman year, mm-hmm. he told us. But the idea is to keep getting better. What is that? Is it just kind of the old school way? Like, how do you get guys to buy into the idea of continuing to grow and develop, some on their own and some with your guidance?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, we've got to have our finger on it to some degree, but I mean, I have to give Garrison, you know, the lion's share of any credit for what he accomplished. I mean, he did that largely on his own. What we did was put good people around him, and we kind of kept him on the straight and narrow, and helped him focus on the things that matter the most. But he took advantage of his opportunities. When he came in, he was a pudgy 210-pound, you know, H-back, you know, that could shoot it with range, you know, and it took him 8 or 10 games. I mean, he was passing up good shots, and then he was shooting it into people's armpits on other shots. You know, he didn't know good from bad. But it, as he started to figure out is when our best player got injured, and so we just put him in the starting lineup, and he led us in scoring for the rest of the season. From that moment on, he led us in scoring. And then that offseason, he thought, you know what, I'm pretty good at this. He reshaped his body. He completely changed nutrition. He worked harder than anybody we had for the remaining 3 years. He worked on his game with trainers on his own, and he really was self-made in that regard.
Yeah, and of course, took you guys to the NCAA tournament. And then, you know, last year you guys go all the way to the NIT and the NIT finals. How much of the run through the ASUN tournament 2 years ago helped you for the other night against Murray?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if at all. I mean, what I thought about personally was because our game against Murray 2 days ago, I mean, it was a 15-1 Murray State to Belmont crowd. So it was a virtual road game. And our game at with Lipscomb at Florida Gulf Coast 2 years ago was a road game. It literally was at Florida Gulf Coast in a great environment. And so personally, that was easy for me to say, you know what, that doesn't have to matter at all. Your team can play great. Your team can win this game. Don't even worry about that part of it. But I don't think it had any effect on our players. They don't know any of that story at all.
No, but I mean, you know, in terms of how you substitute, you're a longtime assistant, then you become a head coach. And anyone who's coached knows that, like, that 18-inch move is a big move. And you just kind of start processing things and seeing things different. And obviously, you're a really good player in your own right. So you are already, like, I'm just wondering if there's a level of, like, the first time you do it, I don't know how hyped you were. You're like a level of, it felt like in watching you, nothing fazed you. Like, you knew what was coming. You had a great balance about you. And I just wonder if that is what you've always had or if that is from the experience of having success in that situation in the past.
Yeah, I think my countenance is generally pretty even. I mean, I'm a fiery guy and a demanding coach, but I try not to get too worked up or too emotional about, you know, the situation at hand. You know, I had 4 NCAA tournaments here at Belmont as an assistant. And then the one at Lipscomb, you know, that was the first time they had ever been. You know, it's the first time I'd ever been as a head coach. So I'd be lying if I say that didn't have a special place for me. But the postseason success there, you know, the NIT run we had last year was unbelievable. We won at Davidson, at Greensboro, who was supposed to be the next team into the NCAA tournament. We won at NC State. We beat Wichita State in Madison Square Garden. You know, we had a great run. And so I think I just had some confidence that, you know, this is, you've been here, you've done this. You know, you've got a great team. You got a mature team. You got a team that loves playing together. So just go be yourself.
Okay, so you take on Murray, as you mentioned. You know, it's a virtual road game at the Ford Center. You had played Murray twice this year, lost at their place, beat him at your place. What was the game plan coming in?
Oh, well, it wasn't altered very much at all. Only thing we changed was how we guard their post a little bit, but we didn't do anything else different at all. You know, the games were really slugfest. They're really physical and athletic. We play hard and we're physical. We're not athletic, but so our styles are pretty different. The games have been great, though. The two programs are really, really good. Have a lot of expectation to win, and so I expected it to be a game just like it was, a game that was, you know, just a slugfest for 40 minutes. In this case, both teams played well, though. In our game there, I didn't think we played well. In their game here, I didn't think they played particularly well. They were really sloppy offensively. And I think both teams played pretty well in this last game.
All right. I want to get to your decision to move cross town to Belmont in a second. But obviously, you know, people are going to look and see what Nick was able to do and kind of, it was, you know, jaw dropping in terms of his productivity, in spite of the fact he's playing foul trouble, right? And you know, in 25 minutes to give you 25 and 8 boards, but this team and how it's come together. Granted, you're a Belmont guy. Granted, you knew it because you guys played Belmont every year. But how long did it take you before you felt like it was your team?
Yeah, longer than I anticipated. It was really the one missing link in the whole transition that I didn't think would be as significant as it was, because the relationships were good from the beginning. There was, you know, a lot of times with coaching changes, you know, you talk about all the culture change and, you know, my guys and things. We had none of that. We had a trip to Portugal this summer that helped us accelerate things. You know, but until you get into the season and now all of a sudden you got to play guys and not play guys and you got to come back from losses and you got to figure out how to win and injuries and everything else, that's when you really understand and learn who each other are. So it took a while, and I was surprised by that. But even then, it didn't take as long as it would have, you know, if it were somebody new stepping in here altogether.
Who's evolved and bought in and changed the most?
Oh, changed? I don't think we've had any wholesale change. I mean, there's so much similarities between what we're doing now and what was already being done, both behind the scenes and on the floor, that it hasn't required a whole lot of significant change. Naturally, I had better relationships with some of those guys than others. I recruited two of them really, really hard, two of these guys really hard, and a couple of others at least a little bit. So there was some familiarity there. Yeah, it's hard to answer.
Okay. All right. So you come down to the end of the game. You got a side OB. And what I'm like always interested in is not just, I mean, you guys, you've done it. Lipscomb run great stuff. Coach Bird ran great stuff. You know, everybody on social media sees it, copies it, points it out. But when you're over there, how much of your final play also correlates to the inbound itself? Right, because it was all together, right? It wasn't just you throw it in, okay, now we got it in. Now, it was all kind of fluid and congruent, if you will. Like if they would have come out in a 1-3-1 zone or trapped the inbounds pass, right? Like what is the level of planning and preparation that goes in last second play?
Not very good on my part, because my assistant coaches asked earlier today, what would you have done if they were in zone? And I said, I have no idea.
Call another timeout and then they switched to man.
We would have been toast.
Hey, I got a great story for you real quick. Okay.
All right.
So Fran McCaffrey, who's at Iowa, he can account for this is the story he told me. So he played for a guy named, his freshman year, he played at Wake Forest. He played for a guy named Kyle Tacy. And he said, he told me a story. He said, we're playing Lefty Drizel at Maryland. And we're down one, end of the game. Underneath our own basket, we call a timeout, come over, and the assistants and the head coach, you know, they're arguing about what to run. And he's like a starting freshman point guard. And they're talking and discussing what they want to run so long that they come over and he comes like, Fran, just call something. So they go out, they're walking out there, and he like mumbles like, let's run number two, you know, like let's try and figure it out. So they line up, they're right about to take the ball inbounds, and Lefty Drizel looks at their alignment and calls timeout, right? Essentially allowing Wake Forest to put in a play because they ran out of time previously. And he said, and I was walking over to the bench and I thought to myself, this is a profession I need to get in. One guy didn't know what play to call in. The second guy wants to find out what play the guy's running, so he gives the other guy more time. I got to get in on this business, right? So as much as you're being lauded, like, man, that Casey Alexander, he runs some good stuff. Truth is, had they gone zone, it would have been a whole bag of nothing, huh?
Yeah, well, it would have been a bag of nothing. But I'll say this. We have talked tirelessly about it doesn't matter what we've called. If they surprise you with zone, run the play. Now, the play wouldn't have worked as well, obviously.
Right.
But we would have still got a lot of movement. We would have still created an opportunity for them to make a mistake. And even if it's – I mean, there's no guarantee that the play is going to work if they play man. You know. So, but you give it your best effort. And the play that we ran – if it doesn't work, then our best ball handler and playmaker and scorer has the ball in his hands with 5 seconds to go with a side cleared. So it's not
right. And you got spacing in the corner, spacing on the wing as well for a driving kick.
Right, right.
What's it called?
Liberty.
It's called Liberty. Did you steal it from Liberty?
Yeah. Heck yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the way it's done, right?
People thought I had it all together. I don't know what to do against zone. I don't even have my own plays.
I think it works against zone anyway, because you still have the you know, if it's a 2-3, the back man helps, and you still have drive and kick, and you got the weak side corner. It is amazing. You know, I think the hard part in running back doors, the great part in running, and obviously, you know, Coach Bird ran the panic play that worked, didn't work last year in the tournament, but did work at UCLA. But the great thing about backdoors is, you know, kids are so hyped up. They overplay. They want to get a run out and try and get a steal and be a hero. The other side to it, though, is how do you manage, like you said, your best ball handler not throwing it if it's not open? How do you discuss that?
Yeah, well, you don't discuss it. I mean, they just got to be players in that moment. You know, no matter how good I am at drawing something up, they've got to execute it and be players and improvise for whatever the situation allows. And you know, you do that all season long, and that's what differentiates one player from the next is the ability to do that.
Yeah, I called a Belmont game against Arizona in the NCAA tournament. This is in 2013. I think it was 13, it was my first year doing games for CBS. I want to say it was in Salt Lake. And what struck me was, like, I thought you guys are really good, and you know, I got a ton of respect for Coach Bird, but it was just a bad matchup, right? Like, you guys played small, and that was a year where Arizona played small, and so their small players were better than your small players. How much of your success in the NCAA tournament this year depends on matchups?
Well, probably a lot of it for all the same reasons, you know. But it doesn't always have to be that way. You know, some of our best, you know, we played Duke in 2008, and they were Duke, for goodness sakes, you know. But we went, and they were athletic, they were active, they denied stuff, they just switched everything. Well, you know, we used that to our advantage and made a way to work. We didn't win the game, but we had two chances to win in the last 30 seconds, and probably the game that put Belmont on the map.
If you were going to tell a young assistant coach when it's time to go do your own thing, obviously you got to get offered a job first, right? Mm-hmm. Tons of assistant coaches would like to do their own thing, but they don't. You know, you left for Stetson before coming back to Lipscomb. What should go into that decision?
Quality of life, being somewhere where you know, where you trust the people you're working with and for. You know, their jobs are not all the same. I think a lot of us are misguided in thinking that, hey, I'm just going to chase the next job, and they're not at all the same. You need to be somewhere that fits your personality. You need to be somewhere that that you can stay for a long time if needed, and that's how you should choose.
Okay, so then last year in the offseason, and it happened pretty quickly, Coach Bird decides to retire. What was that like for you? Like, take me through the. Yeah. Did you know he was going to retire?
Well, yes. I mean, I knew he was. He had told me that he was threatening to retire for a couple of years, but I thought it would be a couple of more years from then. When he told me about a week before the announcement, I was surprised.
So you know, you're sitting on this. You know, right? Did he call you and say, I want you to come take it? Like, what was that discussion like?
Well, we had a lot of conversations, intermittent conversations over the years about, you know, what would happen. But you know, he's got a guy on staff, his associate head coach, Brian Ayers, who I worked with here at Belmont for 13 years, and he's been at Belmont for 21 years, and he's a very capable coach as well. So he had to be fair to him. You know, he's not going to run out and promote me for the job when he's got a guy on his staff who could also warrant attention. And so, but we talked about it a little bit, and he would just, you know, he would give me a little disclaimer here and something there, a little nugget there. And, you know, so I had an idea about kind of how things would go, but you never really know. You know, I literally didn't have any conversations with anybody of any substance at all until after we got back from the NIT. I think he announced on a Monday. We were already in New York City. The NIT semifinals were Tuesday. We played the finals on Thursday, came back on Friday, met with Belmont on Saturday, met with Lipscomb on Sunday, took Monday to think about it, decided it on Tuesday, announced on Wednesday.
Did you vacillate at all?
Did I what?
Vacillate at all? Was there ever a moment like, huh?
Oh yeah. It was hard. It was much more difficult than people think that it was for me to make the move because Lipscomb was so good to me, and it was a magical year, really. I mean, it was we had an awesome season with awesome kids, and I loved every minute of it. So within days of that experience ending, me having to walk into that locker room and tell those kids I was leaving was gut wrenching. It was really a tough decision. You know, how about this? I met with my Lipscomb team. I'm sure they knew that it was a possibility, but I tell them that, hey, I'm going to be gone for the rest of the week, and you guys are, I think we were coming, spring break was coming up, things like that. So let's meet in the locker room at 9:55 after the 9 o'clock classes are over. So I tell them at 9:55 that I'm leaving, and I meet with the Belmont team in their locker room at 10:30. 35 minutes later. It's 2 miles
right
drive.
Down the street. 2 miles
drive. So
yeah.
It was, and I cried the whole way. So I had to turn that off.
Are you, is that just a radio media line, or did you legitimately cry?
No, I cried. I cried big tears the whole way. I mean, not because I wasn't sad. It was just an emotional thing. I mean,
oh,
I
no
love
question.
Those guys. Yeah, I love
no,
those
you,
guys.
You built Lipscomb into an NCAA tournament team, and yeah. with that group that stuck together, you know, NCAA tournament, NIT finals. Like it was. No, I completely get it. Completely get it. It's like redoing a house, you know, taking a house to the studs, and then somebody goes like, "Hey, I'm going to give you every penny you ever wanted for the house," and then you sell it, and you're like, "Wait, I kind of loved when I built." Like, okay,
yeah,
well,
right.
Go do it now. You got to go do it again to a house that somebody else built, which is a beautiful house in Belmont. What is it like now to be the head coach of a place you played and you were a longtime assistant?
It's great, you know, and that's part of the beauty of the change is, you know, that there aren't many coaches that get to walk into a job and they literally know practically every living former player, many of the season ticket holders, a lot of the administration, you know, have spent 20 years, you know, at that job before or on campus as a student, you know. So I met my wife here. My kids grew up coming to Belmont games, you know. So it was, in that respect, it was completely easy. And as difficult as it was to leave Lipscomb, it was just as gratifying and joyful to come to Belmont.
Okay, last thing. You guys average about 80 points a game. I think you're 15th in field goal percentage offense. Like, you guys... You play beautiful offensive basketball. And I think a lot of times younger coaches, and Belmont's always been really well coached offensively, but a lot of times younger coaches, they get caught up in wanting to be freer offensively than their mentor or whatever. And sometimes I think it hurts coaches' success. You know, younger guys, they want to let their guys. How have you managed to let your team play at a good pace and play with freedom and yet still shoot such a high percentage? What's the secret to the sauce?
Yeah, I've always been a little less conservative than Coach Bird to begin with, as far as offense goes. Willing to for a turnover here, you know, so that we might get a basket later there, kind of a thing. But there's so much commonality between, you know, what I've always done. I mean, gosh, it's the only place I ever worked. How much different can I be, you know, from what Belmont was already doing? But then, you know, I inherited a good group of players too, and they didn't have to adapt. You know, I think somebody told me today that, you know, this will be the second year in a row maybe that we lead the country in assists. Our assist turnover margin is really good.
604 assists in 33 games. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the best by a sizable margin. You know.
Well, I hadn't looked at it, but it makes sense. And our assist turnover ratio is really good. You know, so that just goes along with kind of, again, you know, how we build a roster, having guys that understand how to play the game, guys that are willing to share the ball, the extra pass, you know, is one that we want to make, you know, and that's the reason why the shooting percentages are what they are. We're very, you know, as you know, the game these days is almost nothing but ball screens, and yep. We're on the back end of that. You know, we get a lot more player movement, ball movement. We'll use some ball screens, but it's not nearly we never have anybody out there pounding it, or at least I don't want it.
Yeah, it obviously clearly works for you. It's worked for university. Listen, I couldn't be happier for you and your family and for the folks at Belmont. It's been an amazing year so far. Keep it going. We look forward to seeing who you play a week from Sunday. And thanks so much for giving us your perspective on your program.
We'll do our best. I really enjoyed the time and appreciate it.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
All right, thanks so much for listening. This is the first in the litany of championship week, crawling into the NCAA tournament with a little NBA thoughts, all ball podcast. Remember, you can listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific. You can download the podcast for that anywhere you download podcasts. And make sure you tell a friend that this is the place to where you get a lot of hoops knowledge. A lot of you have grabbed me at events or tweeted at me or DM me on IG at Gottlieb Show. And said how much you like it. If there's things you want to hear, people you want to hear it on, Don't be afraid to ask. And make sure you ask a question on Twitter, @Gottlieb Show. We'll answer all those questions upcoming. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.